Macro Voices is pleased to bring you this encore presentation of an interview which originally aired in full color video on Real Vision Television at an earlier date. Real Vision is a paid subscription video on demand channel for finance. In partnership with Real Vision Television, we are pleased to offer Macro Voices subscribers a free trial subscription to Real Vision. To sign up, go to realvisiontv.com/discount/Macro Voices. Macro Voices does not receive any commission or other compensation if you purchase a Real Vision subscription. We are proud to promote Real Vision because we believe they are the only other financial media outlet that shares our values and standards in financial journalism.
This is Aaron Chan of Macro Voices. For this final holiday special Real Vision TV Encore, we are pleased to share an interview which originally aired on June 2, 2016, between Raul Powell of Real Vision and Edward Mizrahi, Goldman Sachs alum and founder of Eaton Park. In this interview, Mr. Mizrahi takes us on a grand tour of the world's emerging markets, highlighting the potential risks and best opportunities to profit. For unbiased financial insight from the best minds in the business, I cannot recommend Real Vision Television enough. Simply put, this video on demand platform for investors showcases very smart people honestly discussing relevant issues in an interesting and engaging manner. The intellectual gene pool is deep, so go have a swim with their 7-day free trial by going to realvisiontv.com/discount/macrovoices and use the discount code macrovoices.
Edward, fantastic to have you. Let's just go a bit about your background so people know, because you and I work together in different offices doing different things, but I'd love you to just tell us about yourself.
Thank you. First, thank you for having, and I've enjoyed reading your stuff for a few years, and it's my pleasure to come here. Look, I started in the investing business at Goldman, and the prop side of Goldman at the time in the mid-90s, and what at the time was called the Risk Arbitrage Group, who then changed a few times. My focus at the time was Latin America, because I grew up in Spain, I spoke the languages of most of the region, and that qualified me, even though I didn't really have much idea about investing. Language skills was enough at the time. And that started my whole, like, effective attraction and love affair with investing, because we started that. And at the beginning, it was more process and event-oriented investing, but then over time, we migrated, and we grew that group a lot over that decade that I was there. And I was there, I stayed, I became a partner, I did other things at Goldman. And then in the 2004, I decided that maybe it was time for another challenge. And at the time, the person who had been my boss for most of the time at Goldman, Eric Mindich, was thinking of starting another hedge fund. More coming back to the days of what we used to do in the 90s. And so I joined him to be one of the founding partners of Eaton Park, who...
They were the biggest hedge fund launch in the world
at
the time.
Yeah, they were one. I mean, we were one of the ones at that time. There was another one, Convexity, I think, like, you know, from Harvard. But yeah, it was incredible. I mean, now that I have to fundraise, when I look at how we raised that money or how Eric, it's crazy. I can't understand. It's hard to understand. But especially we had like crazy strict terms, not just the amount of money we raised, but under amazing terms. Anyway, that was a great thing. I did mostly emerging markets and Europe for them, and it was a great run. And, you know, towards the end of it, there was a combination. We struggled a little bit in some of the stuff we were doing in EM. As a firm, we were struggling a little bit too. And I think Eric wanted to kind of change. And I thought that it was a good time maybe to bring that umbilical cord that I had had with him. I still think meeting him was the best thing that's happened in my career. But at one time, sometimes you need to break out. And you always like to do it when everything's great. Sometimes it's not. But my relation with him still is really good. And so I left, and I realized when I was leaving that I missed investing too much. And so I kind of decided that I wanted to restart doing that, but in a very much more niche, much more the way I would like to do it, much more focused on a performance-oriented orientation, not really in scale, one where I could spend my time, where my job 5 years from now, 7 years from now, would still be exactly what I do today, which is 85% of the time looking at ideas and situation, not having to spend a lot of time on managing large organizations or et cetera. It's not really what I want to do anymore.
Where are you based? Based here in London?
I'm based now here in London, which is a fabulous place to to do what we do, especially for me who has to travel a lot of, cross a lot of time zones, not travel as much, but cross a lot of time zones. London is very, very convenient because, you know, you don't have to have crazy hours to be able to know what's happening in Asia. And as long as you don't mind being bothered in the middle of dinner, you can track what's going on in the US pretty well. So it's a very, very convenient place. And also, a lot of people come through here. So, I think one of the things I've realized is I need to travel less than I used to. Because you see, you know, between the internet, between technology, between information, and between how people travel, you just can see things very well. So
let's talk about EM, because there's a ton of stuff going on. And EM was not very sexy for a long time. Now, suddenly, there's a lot going on. So there's opportunity, I think, both sides of the coin in EM.
Yeah, absolutely.
So where's the most interesting place to you right now?
Well, look, I will tell you, I think that EM is very, very interesting. And let me tell you, I think that one of the things that makes it interesting is that it's so disliked. And it's not because you want to be a contrarian, because I'm not always contrarian. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It's much more because I think there's been a complete exodus of both capital and brain trust on EM, because everybody's focusing on everything else. And there's just a lot of different things. And the second thing that's happened is I think the EM of today is not the EM that we grew up with in the 90s or in the 2000s. I have a great chart that I show in some of the stuff of presentation is that if you look at historically, the correlation between countries and sectors and EM used to be pretty good, pretty high. Meaning, if you were making an EM bet, you were kind of making a beta bet on what was happening, either on growth, etc. And whether you bought this country or that country, generally, things kind of moved very much together. And over the last 5 years, you've had a massive dispersion. Sectors and countries do very differently. So you can have some EM countries that do really well, some EM countries that do very poorly.
It's great for somebody like you, isn't
it? Exactly, which means it's created an opportunity set where you don't have to be bullish or bearish necessarily. You can just pick the places you're interested and not, and et cetera. And so I think as a result of it, it's interesting. The third thing is I think that after 3 or 4 years of, you know, a big beating in terms of currencies, in terms of rates, in terms of equities, the entry point in EM is interesting. You know, I think that, you know, for example, most EM currencies, we could talk about China a little bit later and Asia, but most EM currencies are either cheap or as cheap as they've been in a very long time. Rates in a lot of these places are higher than they've been in a long time. I'm just saying you have a starting conditions which are better for if you have a little bit of a perspective beyond the things. And so I'm going to give you a small anecdote, which I thought was representative of this opportunity set. I met with a life insurance here in the EU, in Europe. I was meeting them and analyzing the company, not this. But I asked them what they were doing with, you know, this company has hundreds of billions of euros of investment portfolio. And I said how much local EM they owned. And he said, very little. It's very risky, he said to me, the gentleman. I said, okay. And I said, can I give you an example? I said, he says, yes. He says, so I said, so you own primarily Europe treasury? Yes. I said, Euro bonds, which I don't have to tell you where they yield. And US, which, okay, yield a little bit more, but currency adjusted for, this is a European who has to hedge. My guess is that he gives back everything and things. I said to him, I said, look, if you bought, for example, a Brazilian 10-year bond, this was like 4 or 5 months ago, I said, you could buy that bond and make a 10-year 15% nominal. That was more or less where the rates were, more or less at the time. I said, if you buy that bond, and you can, by the way, he doesn't have mark-to-market. He's got long-term liabilities. He doesn't have to worry like I have to worry about, you know, every 3 months, you know, every month people worrying, or every 6 months people worrying. I said, if you buy that bond, the currency would have to go down 85% from today for the next 10 years for you to break even. And the currency you're buying has already gone down about 45% from its high. Okay, is it mathematically possible that it could lose another 85%? Of course it is. You know, Venezuela, Zimbabwe, there is examples where currencies go into hyperinflation dynamics. But I would say it's Brazil. I don't think that's the situation that's going to happen. Could a country default in the local currency? It could. There's some probability. I still think low, because in general countries don't like to default on their local bonds that much. But this is. But granted those things, in general, I said, if the currency goes down 85%, you break even. If the currency goes down 50%, you double your money over 10 years. So I said to him, I said, the worst case, one of the worst cases that I can imagine is you break even. Most other cases I can make up, you go from making great returns to astounding returns. And you're telling me that you prefer to own securities where the best case scenario is zero return. How is that possible? So he says to me, it's very volatile. I said, you don't mark to market.
No, and you get paid for the volatility.
That's what I'm saying. And my point is, I think that that's what's happened. There's this psychological barrier that has been created. And I think that's creating an opportunity if you're willing to be a little bit more courageous. There's a saying someone told me yesterday that I thought was very, 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 I thought thoughtful. You only buy Brazil if you don't have a bus. because if you have to explain it, you don't want, it's not worth it. There's a lot of issues, there's corruption, there's all this stuff, etc. It's better not to worry about it. But if you can, if you had your own money or your family, I'm like, this is crazy. You know, people are buying negative yielding bonds where you're guaranteed to lose money. For me, it's inconceivable. So the answer is, I think the starting point is better. That's why I think of this. I also think that Brazil is really the key country to show whether EM makes it or not, more than China. I think China is going to be a debate that you're going to talk about and a lot of very smart people are going to talk about probably for many years to come.
Like Japan was.
Yes, like Japan was. And by the way, correctly so, because there's a lot of issues there that it has. I tend to have the view that they have enough degrees of freedom that they basically can continue to kick the can down the road. Maybe every now and then you get to like what happened last summer or this, where there's a little bit of tension. But in general, they have enough to continue an unsustainable situation for longer.
Yeah.
Whereas I think, and so I think that although China is going to be a source of constant risk, it's going to be like this constant view. Every now and then it'll flare up, every now and then it'll die down, but it's not going to change that dramatically because I don't see how China fixes itself in the next 9 months, but I also don't see how China goes completely belly up in the next 6 to 9 months. Whereas I think there's a reasonable chance that Brazil could really have a proper turn now that they've got their politics a little bit better. And if Brazil turns, suddenly this whole negativity around the whole dynamic, for example, think about Latin America, which has been a crappy place to be. You've had a change of government in Argentina for the better. You've got now Brazil potentially going for better. Situation in Venezuela is unsustainable. It will change sometime in the next 6 months. You're suddenly having a shift to a more normal dynamic in that thing. So I think that there's a better chance that you could do it. So I'm constructive. I think it's real time for do it. I think fixed income is very interesting. There's also a lot of equity stories that are interesting. I'm not particularly bullish on commodity related things. That I'm not. That I think is a very different bet altogether. But yeah, so I think so. But so I'm constructive.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. If I look at Brazil, I was writing the Globe Macro Investor over the weekend, last weekend. And one thing I noticed is the GDP hit now, year on year, is about the largest in the last 40 or 50 years. So what I do know is generally the probability is that the worst is done.
Correct.
I'm not sure the equity markets still offers, but there's some stuff like Electrobras and stuff like that. But then there's the fixed income and currency side, which is a probability game. And once you understand the probabilities of getting your money back, it's hugely interesting.
That's one thing. I think to the lines that sometimes you use in your writing, I think the asymmetry right now is very much biased on your side to be more bullish. It's not guaranteed. There's issues. There is dynamic. It's going to be volatile. But it's when I think how much you could lose if you're wrong versus how it could work out.
And that's not to, so as you know, my core thesis is that the dollar bull market continues.
Yes.
So maybe the real gets weaker, but that still doesn't mean you lose money in bonds, as you
said. That's exactly right. I mean, how much is priced in these things is enormous in the context. And to your point, for example, I don't think it's inconsistent with your view of the dollar getting stronger. Obviously, if the dollar gets 15% stronger in a 3-month period, yes. Because that's kind of a dislocation event that is destructive anyway. But if it's just a gradual bull market in the dollar now that goes on for the next 24 months, I don't see why necessarily.
And not for Brazil. It may be an issue for South Korea, for example.
Yes, no. Asia, I think, is, by the way, the place that I'm less constructive, which is funny because it's where people tend to do more, but I think it's more constructive. I think the rest of Asia, the impact of China is just, you know.
Let's come on to Asia in a minute. Because I think that's another interesting conversation. But I want to talk about Argentina and Venezuela.
Fine.
Because I think they're both fascinating.
I'll tell you,
Venezuela is something I've been writing about, saying, listen, there's a huge opportunity in the air.
So I'm going to say something that normally either finishes my meetings very soon or gets them interesting. One of our biggest positions is dollar debt in Venezuela. Dollars. Not. I don't obviously own any local currency debt.
That's right, yeah.
Look, Venezuela is, I mean, there will be textbooks written. I mean, it will compete with Zimbabwe in terms of how, the thing is, Zimbabwe didn't have that much, you know, in terms of itself to ruin. I mean, they had a farming industry, they had an industry. Venezuela has this incredible natural resource, and they are managing, I mean, in discovering new amazing ways to basically mismanage it. When you think the mismanagement is up to a certain degree, they come up with some new regulation that makes that mismanagement look, oh, I wish we had the old regime. But I think that there's, you know, I have a lot of friends in Venezuela, and we have fairly reasonable contacts in terms of the people who live there, not, you know, the government and everything. It's impossible to really get a feel. And Chavismo was based on two concepts. You nationalize everything you can, and you always pay your debt. It's an interesting idea. He was very, 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 very focused on the fact that if I don't pay my debts and I don't show like I'm a civil guy, then all what I'm saying about everything kind of loses completely with this. And he was a very pragmatic guy. And by the way, this is the only reason why they still continue to pay, because they realized that if they stop paying, first PDVSA would have a problem that would get completely unworked. And secondly, it's really something that they think undermines their whole dynamic of being, because their whole idea is we are for the people, not that we're like some crazy people that believe in anarchy. No, that's not what they like to describe. So anyway, look, I think that we're in the throes of the last period of Maduro and the current government, but it's a very difficult thing to handicap how things are going to work out. In Argentina, there was at least a political democratic process. You could see how Cristina was probably not going to be able to get the constitutional change to get another mandate, and so she couldn't run, and then you probably had a good chance that someone else could win. With Venezuela, the politics and the legal thing are more complicated. Having said that, I agree with you. I think, you know, it's not a place to go now because it's really dangerous and you have to be careful. But in terms of assets and you can things there, it's crazy.
I'm saying it's an amazingly beautiful country. As you said, crazy dangerous. The thing I've been looking at with a few family offices is just buying some land.
Yeah, I think it's...
Because, you know, because then you don't have buildings that anybody can take over, do anything with, because you don't know what the last throes of a regime look like. But to buy land, people need the dollars.
I think you're right. I think the issue that you have to be careful is avoid the mistakes that some people did, like in places like Ukraine, everything. You bought land, you thought it was okay, and then the title dynamic...
That will change if you've got something on the land. If you're farming, drilling...
Yeah, then
If you buy kind of construction land or whatever, that's nothing on it...
Then you probably are okay. I agree. I think you have to do it. I agree with you. I think that it will change sometime in the next year. Hopefully sooner. I'm not sure. But he has passed... It's a little bit what happened to Dilma in Brazil. What happened is... Presidents and governments can stay in power with crazy situations and everything that all of us think are this, as long as their popularity kind of stays to a certain level. And, you know, because people say, oh, the Dilma is a coup and everything. And look, I'm not going to go into the constitutional debate of what exactly the impeachment process went, but her popularity in the country was 8%. I'm just saying, 92% of the people in the country didn't want her in power anymore. I'm not saying that that's the right argument from a democratic thing, but it takes a little bit of the whole legitimate, you know, you take this. And Maduro is basically losing it very quickly now because the situation is you know, when you get to, you know, how you've seen other hyperinflation periods, the deterioration is dramatic, and particularly for the poor.
Yeah.
Because they have no way to...
Because they were looked after at first. That was the whole idea.
The whole idea.
Now suddenly they get hit.
Now they get properly hit. And now they're saying, okay, this guy's not helping us anymore. Now they want... something else. Look, Argentina is a different thing. Argentina, for example, I think is, I don't share the enthusiasm that everybody has today on Argentina.
Yeah.
I think that things have changed dramatically. And I must say, first, the election of Macri was a better outcome than I could have expected, let's say 6 months before. And I think that he's picked a very good team of very qualified people that the financial markets like. You know, say, I mean, some of the guys I've known for a long time, they were like the JP Morgan Argentine economist. They were, you know, Pratt Guy, who's the finance minister. I remember coming, seeing him, you know, he was the Andean economist for JP Morgan, I think, covering Argentina. So I'm saying, so it's people that feel comfortable, people who are reasonable, they've worked in proper places, they've been trained, they're real economists. And I think that they, so from a point of view of the face of everything, it's been very good. On top of it, I think he's moved very quickly and very well on certain issues that were complicated. I think resolving the holdouts as quickly as he did is to his credit. It was, although everybody can say, no, it was all pre-planned, everything, it's complicated to resolve these things. And he managed to get it and do it. So I think that they deserve a lot of credit for doing that, re-entering the financial markets, et cetera. Having said that, this is an economy that for 8 or 9 years has been totally unbalanced because of subsidies, because of subsidies. Because the amazing thing of Argentina is that people in Argentina haven't had a tough economic time. People may have not been able to get the money out of banks as much as they wanted. But if you look at growth, if you look at things in salary increases and everything, you know, I mean, part of the reason why there's so much inflation is because they, you know, the salaries have been increasing. In general, employment has been good. And so you're now going to get to a period where he actually needs to start putting the economy back to a place that is sustainable. And that's politically very complicated because he's going to have to start doing things that are going to hurt the people. And he gets a honeymoon period, which is probably about finished in terms of Argentine politics. And I think people are underestimating that this is a complicated country to govern.
So you think it probably gets worse before it gets better? I think it looks like it is going, in terms of the economy, not the overall picture may improve, but he's got so much reform and stuff to do.
He has to do, and it's not an easy country to reform. It's not a, so the answer is, don't get me wrong, I think that look, Argentina just issued a lot of debt, you know, the first century back in the market at levels that I think are reasonable. I wouldn't buy them because I don't think they, I can buy other things that are better, but I don't think it's crazy where they're issuing. But am I very bullish on Argentina now in terms of equities or credit dynamics? I think no. I think that is a little bit of a... The best analogy I can give you right now for Argentina is, I think, the Modi effect in India.
Yeah.
You know, good leader, great team, great intentions. Now welcome to reality. And I think, and a lot of euphoria into it, and I think it's just nearly going to be very, very hard for him to meet that level. And so I think that you're probably going to get a couple of years of, I think, nothing bad, but just subpar. And so it's not something I'm particularly excited about. Focus. On top of it, if you want to stay liquid, it's a difficult place to find that many things to buy, you know, liquid, because there's, you know, the equity market remains very small. Fixed income obviously is larger, and I said, but you know, long-term yields in Argentina are now 6.5 something in dollars. I think it's okay, you know, but I wouldn't, nothing to write home about. Let me put it that way.
So let's move on a bit to Asia now.
Yeah.
What are you thinking? I mean, there's a whole different, lots of different parts. Talk to me your overall views. Right,
so we're excited about India. I think we share, you know, I read some stuff about this. We're excited. I mean, the excitement is not always easy to translate into finding interesting situations to buy. Because in India, we still have issues regarding corporate governance on some situations. And
it's not that cheap, is it?
It's not that cheap. But, you know, our most expensive stock in our portfolio is an Indian bank. And with that, everybody will know which one it is. But the issue is, it's expensive on some metrics, but on others, given how predictable and high growth their business is, I just think it's a great thing to own. And there are certain pockets of the Indian markets interesting. So the answer is, we like the macro, we like the dynamic. I think Modi is a figure that at least is always pointing in the right direction. Like, the fact that he can't always get everything done, or the political system and the state system is complicated. If you have someone that's constantly pointing in the right direction, companies will do things, investments will do things, because they know, anybody who invests in India know how complicated it is to invest in India. The reason why you might not do it is not because you think it's complicated or bureaucratic, et cetera. It's because you worry that someone's going to change direction 2 years down the line and your project is suddenly stuck. I think with him, you have a lot more comfort that, okay, it might take longer, et cetera, but it's not going to be. And I think that's a very powerful dynamic. The other thing is they have a more structure. So the answer is we like India very much. Also, obviously, they're a big beneficiary of commodities staying depressed. So, you know, it's helpful for them, which is also a good thing. And so, you know, I think that there's, however, I would say that my excitement on India is not always shared by how much it can be in the portfolio, because it's hard to find that many situations where you can effectively play that dynamic. A lot of, you know, as I said, you say things like, oh, I want to play infrastructure in India, or I want to play this, and you realize a lot of the companies in the infrastructure sector are just not good companies to invest in, you know? So you are frustrated because you like the idea, you can see it happening, but you realize that as a public investor, it's not always easy.
Yeah, that's what I was about to raise the point. I think India is probably better as a private investor.
Yeah, because with the right combination. I agree. It's, as I said, it's, but we're very constructive, and we think that it is the country that I think you can see more likely to sustain this high, you know, mid to high single digit nominal growth, you know, real growth rates for a period of time without any obvious, you know, unless you think Pakistan goes crazy or something like that, without any necessarily having to make any massive assumptions about the world or...
And because it's relatively uncorrelated to the rest of the world, it's not like half of Southeast Asia, which is the global business cycle.
That's
India
exactly right.
Kind of does its own thing, and that's...
It's kind of a reassuring thing when you don't have to worry. Like, you know, does Fed policy really happen to India? You know, whatever. Yes, in the short run, but not really. You know, because the whole opportunity of the whole dynamic of the country is so strong. So, yeah. So we like India very much. I think that in generally, we are not as negative on China as, let's say, conventional wisdom would be.
Yeah. You think it's more of a muddle through?
It's muddle through. I think of this. I would definitely not describe us as the best Chinese experts ever. Don't get me wrong. I am not the things. But we think that countries get in trouble when there's two particular big weaknesses. One is if they have a system that represses, you know, doesn't allow financials to kind of unleash, which unfortunately China has a little bit of that because of the currency. Although, for example, we think that the more they relax capital controls, the more likely they'll have a crisis. You know, everybody's telling them, you know, capital. And we think, my guess is they're not going to relax capital controls that quickly.
Because otherwise money runs.
Exactly, because they don't want to lose that ability. But anyway, so they have that. But however, what they don't have is their financial sector, although the NPLs are obviously much greater than what they report, they still have a very profitable banking system, which means that they can, you know, if as long as they don't have to mark to market tomorrow, they can continue to little by little clean up the system over time. So we think they can muddle through. Will they do a big devaluation one day? Maybe, you know.
I was thinking about this capital control thing and the MSCI inclusion.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a very neat way of getting money out and money in at the same time.
Absolutely.
Because a lot of money has to come in to invest in MSCI if in the Chinese stock market, and you can actually get a lot of money out the door.
This is exactly, by the way, what's funny to me is that this is what happened in the Gulf. Yeah. I mean, the peak of the most of the markets there coincided with MSCI. And people say, oh, it's great, the markets. And I said, normally when those countries want MSCI to come, it's because they want to get some money out. I mean, it is true.
Yeah.
Like, people don't realize that no one gives away anything for free. You know, these locals don't like to sell things at the wrong price. They like to sell this. And so... So I think that, so we're more constructive. We like some stories there.
We had an interesting, sorry to interrupt, at the Global Macro Investor Roundtable, which you didn't come to.
Yeah. But I will go to one of them.
So we had the two camps. You know, we had the China big deval camp, you know, buy the out of the money options on the currency, and then the camp which was the muddle through, they'll cut interest rates.
Yeah.
And basically we figured out between us that the easiest thing to do was buy the bonds, because bonds should rally, yield should fall. And with the coupon, you can buy all of the out-of-the-money options. And either way, you're going to win in a bet like that.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's fairly bad. Look, I was in a conference a year and a half ago. And I was in a panel with one of the very, very bearish Chinese, very vocal, very Chinese, very good, very articulate. And for purposes of of kind of creating some tension, not tension, creating some excitement in the discussion, I talked about how we were long Chinese banks, which I think he nearly had a heart attack when I told this. But what was funny to me about the whole conversation was that he expressed an incredibly, incredibly bearish outlook for China. Incredibly, incredibly bearish. And then when he had to pitch a stock, he picked Vipshop, which is one of those flash sales e-commerce companies in China. And my point is, you can be generally bearish on China. For example, let me tell you, in our fund, we have some renminbi puts because they don't cost that much. And therefore, why not? I'm really not that smart to know whether it's going to happen soon or not. But I'm happy to have a little bit of the portfolio premium.
The risk reward is good.
It's good. But if I want to buy a company, and so my view is, I think that again, this dynamic. So I am much more on the model through. I think that politically, if you're right on your dollar call, I think the probability goes up.
Yeah.
Because I think they look at where, you know, they look at how the dollar is trading versus the rest of the world, what is happening to their effective. Even though I know they have a more complicated peg now, I still think the dollar is the dominant theme. So I think if the dollar rallied a lot, I think it would change the conversation a little bit. But in our model, more model through scenario, we think that if there's a good story, it's worth owning. However, I think it's a market that it reminds me of when I was at Goldman, we were both at Goldman in the 90s. It's a little bit of Taiwan. It's a retail crazy market. Crazy. I mean, literally. And I mean, things that you can, I mean, you probably read about all these things that's been happening in the last few months regarding the futures on iron ore, eggs, all kinds of things. I mean, it's just mind-boggling what happens. And as a result of it, as an investor, it's a tricky environment to invest when you can get caught in manias up and down, driven by complete things that you have no relation to, because no one can understand the average retail investor in China and how. And you know what happens in China is that everything is like, oh, there was 6 million retail investors that decided to buy this thing. You know, not a few. So I do this thing. So we like some stories. You know, we think the e-commerce story has a lot of legs there, et cetera. We've looked at things. So we like those two places primarily in terms of dynamic. We think the rest of Asia, honestly, is in a very tough spot. In a very tough spot. Because basically, let me just bring it back to America. For Mexico, I always used to say the best thing that happened to Mexico is that it was next to the U.S. Because when you have next to you one of the countries that has fastest growth, fastest development, et cetera, it's just pools. It just pools. The problem with a lot of Asia now is that it's next to China, where you have everything that everybody else does, but in a scale that is totally disproportionate. And where on top of it, they're willing to do things uneconomically the way you and I would think about it from a point of view of return for all kinds of other reasons, social stability, whatever the reason is. I think it puts the other countries in a very, very difficult competitive situation because China doesn't bring that much from you and can compete against this. So, for example, I think Korea is in a tricky, tricky spot. So the answer is we're less constructive secularly on the rest of that because the more stress China has, the more that stress is and going to be.
It's always interesting because investors are always looking at the previous events that occurred. The previous event was Asia, China, the commodity bull market, all of that stuff. And everyone's hated Latin America. And as you said, it's starting to shift that Latin America is starting to become interesting. They were right to hate it.
No, it was a totally good call.
But it's starting to shift. Asia, people are still like, well, I'm still comfortable with a lot of that. And I think I'm much more concerned by these countries, as you mentioned.
I mean, I find it interesting, for example, I'll tell you what I found interesting is the degree of bearishness on China. But for example, the crazy bullishness on Japan, the degree of craziness on Japan, or the comfort with Asia, I don't find them consistent. If China really goes into a complete meltdown mode and the currency devalues and everything, Japan has like a mother of all problems. I don't care how shareholder friendly the companies are becoming. That's not really what's going to matter. You know, I was telling you that I'm much more of a bottoms up guy that wants to make sure that I don't get whipsawed by the macro.
Yeah.
That's what's going to happen. So we think that you're now in a phase of China where China, unfortunately, is going to do what they think is right for them. And what is right for them is not necessarily that good for the neighbors.
Yeah.
But not because they're trying to be predatory or they're... It's just because they've got a scale advantage that is a big, big advantage in this situation. So the answer is, we don't find as many that interesting things to do. I have very little exposure in things. I also will tell you that except for Korea, many of the other Asian markets are relatively liquid, much less liquid than people think.
Yeah.
And so we're not that...
That's a question. Liquidity generally is pretty bad.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that in emerging markets? I mean, most emerging market people, you will say price, obviously.
Yeah.
But part of it is you just don't know what liquidity is. Yeah. So in China, even yesterday, had this huge plummet in the stock market.
I saw it. Crazy.
I mean, how do you deal with this stuff?
Look, I think that... liquidity is... Let me tell you, liquidity is a big problem in general. And when you grew up doing emerging markets, especially for a long time, where a lot of these countries were frontiers and they were even less liquid, you have a lot more respect for issues like flows, dynamics, because you know they matter. Maybe not on a long term or whether a company may be worth, but on a short term dynamic. I think the liquidity in EM, you know, has basically become more and more concentrated in a smaller number of securities. So the liquidity of the most liquid EM names remains relatively good. But now the tail of where that gets cut is much higher.
Yeah.
So whereas before, maybe companies 150 and higher were fairly liquid, now it's 75 and higher. And the 75 to 150 that you used to think were liquid now are not that liquid. So it's tricky. You know, we focus in what I do now. One of the things I struggled in my last, when I was at Eaton Park, is we did have a bunch of illiquid things. And honestly, in hindsight, I mispriced liquidity. Even me, who I've done a long time this, I mispriced it. And I realized that maybe I'm not that good at pricing liquidity. So I want to focus on things where I don't have to price liquidity. Because I think when you do privates, you can price liquidity in a different way because you have more control, you have more understanding, etc. When you're in that middle zone of the public markets where they're public, so you don't have the same access that if you own it privately, but they're illiquid, you're basically subject to like a beta world. And I think, so the answer is, it's but look, we generally think it's a bigger problem. I would tell you, I think it's a bigger problem. Honestly, I think it's a bigger problem for developed market credit markets than for EM. Because in equities, it's a problem for equities, but equities trade and clear. You know, at one moment, you're going to get a trade. You need to sell $50 million of the stock. Okay, it might go down 8%, but it will trade eventually. We see things in the credit market that are just surreal. Surreal. I mean, companies that have issued billion-dollar bonds that if you try to sell 2 million bonds, it's a problem. And the market, and you know, obviously, you've written about this, but et cetera, the intermediation system has basically disappeared because of the regulation has basically made banks very, very unwilling to market make. And I think that that is. So I'm much more worried about liquidity in the credit markets. Because in the equities, normally things clear eventually,
yeah.
And there's visibility of it in credit. And you have to see how many bonds get issued. And 95% of the bonds get bought by four people who then put it away, which is fine. But those four people that put it away are mostly mutual funds with daily liquidity. Which means that if for whatever reason one day, let's say rates do go up, I know that it seems unthinkable right now, but I'm pretty sure they will go up one day. And suddenly there's outflows of all these people. I don't know what's going to happen because the scale thing. So I think that's probably, that's the part of liquidity that worries me more than the EM1 particularly.
So we talked a bit before about Brazil and price. One thing I think people really misunderstand is, you know, we talked about Venezuela. I'm sure a lot of people will be listening to this going, Venezuela, that's ridiculous.
I know, crazy.
And my argument is always, it depends how it's priced. If it's priced cheap enough, then you're being paid for kind of revolution risk or expropriation of asset risk. And Russia's a classic example of a market that people either love or absolutely hate.
I generally have learned over time that I don't either love or hate any markets anymore. I would say we find Russia to be a great trading market. Not a great investing market, but a great trading market.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm very happy to buy something in India that I'm hoping I'm going to own for 2 or 3 years, and hopefully they compound the earnings the way I want to, et cetera. In Russia, I wouldn't make that bet because I don't know, you know.
And they don't manage companies that way.
They don't manage companies that way because the companies themselves know that they can't predict what's going to happen. Is Mr. Putin going to decide to do something else dramatic? Or so having said that, I think it's a very, very, you know, there's some big companies, liquids, with that you can kind of analyze and think about it, and there's great situations to trade. But I think it's a trading market more than an investing market. So I think that when people get very depressed and assets go trade for like very cheap, I think it's worth sometimes looking at it. And when people are a little bit, you know, the things. I think that they've done some things better than they get credit for. I think that the way they've managed the ruble in the face of the collapse in oil prices and everything, I don't think a lot of people would have thought they would have been so willing to have, you know, Putin or strongman, et cetera. Does he want to have like the worst performing currency?
Yeah, they took the currency pain.
They took the currency pain. By the way, that's very healthy.
Yeah.
So the answer is, I think that they don't get full credit for some of the things they do. You know, there's so.
But it's very typical in emerging markets that we use the Western mindset. So we try and analyze Russia because we think they look the same as us and they're part of the same kind of universe as us. You know, they're not. I mean, everybody's very different.
Very different. And so, you know, look, as you say, like, you know, you would hear, you know, if you leave the average description of Putin, people think that he would be despised and everything. And he's probably the most popular leader of any of the, of the G20 countries.
Yeah.
I'm just like, I'm just saying it's. So I think it is. I think that there is some great entrepreneurs in Russia.
Yeah.
Really good. Really, who've built proper businesses and done them in a very good way, and are, they could, you know, if they just happened to have built that business somewhere else, no one would think twice about them, etc. And there is the state sector in Russia that is more complex because the power is so concentrated in one person that it's very hard to know what they want to do. As, you know, people asked me one day, like, I was meeting with someone, I says, well, why don't you own Gazprom? They said, oh, it's very cheap. Someone said, like, it's cheap. And that's all. I said, it is very cheap, but, you know, we like to do analysis and companies, and the only way I can figure out what they're going to do is if I spoke to Mr. Putin and he doesn't really happen to talk to me. So I can't really make that judgment. Whereas companies like Magnit or Yanda, you know, more corporate-oriented sectors, you can. The problem is, since none of us understands fully the web of cronyism that happens in Russia regarding who gave money to whom and supported whom, etc., you're always in risk in Russia of waking up one morning and the guy, you know, this company that was totally fine,
has pissed off Putin.
And it's pissed off Putin for something that you have absolutely no clue and you have no, because it was 18 years ago when they were both.
They were playing football.
Yes, exactly. And that's why I think it's hard to invest. That's why I think it's hard to be
longer term
oriented. But as a trading market, we like it. You know, right now we have a little bit of exposure. You know, we traded the rally reasonably well. You know, obviously, it's very correlated with oil for obvious reasons. But yeah, I'm not against this. And obviously, I think that the interesting trade in Russia is going to be if anybody politically ever thinks that sanctions will get released, you know, at some stage. Obviously, I don't think obviously it's realistic to expect until there's a new administration in the U.S. and et cetera. But, you know, if sanctions get released, there is pent-up money that wants to buy Russian stuff but can't.
Talk about sanctions released, Iran.
Yeah.
What's your view on that?
Look, it's a country that I think that it's very hard for people to disconnect the social, you know, I would say the social and like description that we've had in Iran for the last and probably not inappropriately of some of the ultimate leadership. And therefore, it's really hard for people to disconnect that from the fact that the average Iranian is like you and me.
Yeah.
And, you know, doesn't like, it is what it is in the context. And so it's, I think it's going to take a very long time because the, you know, headline risk is what managers hate, you know, to get blindsided one day or another. And I think there's just too much headline risk in Iran that, like, for whatever reason, there's some incident somewhere. And
to go back to our previous conversation, at a PE of 5.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but I think that there are certain things that, the answer is, I think from a pure objective point of view, I would agree with you.
Right.
You know, I'm just saying in the things. I think that the transition there might take longer.
Yeah.
And therefore, you might get stuck there a little bit longer. That's what I'm only. That's the only thing I'm saying.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
Because you know, we were talking about Venezuela, which is a basket case, but Venezuela, I think you could get a situation where you could get a radical change suddenly. In Iran, it's not as likely. So yes, sanctions will get released, and little by little, hopefully Iran behaves, and you know, from a, you know, from saying from a geopolitical point of view, and little by little people get a little bit more comfortable and a little bit more. But because there isn't that binary change, I think it'll take longer. So the answer is, I think it could stay cheap for longer.
So do you look at frontier markets as well?
Not as much, because I find frontiers to be very prone to liquidity bubbles.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it'll always remind me, I met one guy sometimes, you know, a broker called me and says, oh, can you see this bank? It's a very interesting Kenyan bank. And I looked at it, and by the way, it was very one of the top Kenyan banks, very well positioned. You know, as you can imagine, all these countries, they're jumping steps because everything is going mobile right away. You know, they're basically taking full advantage of technology to allow economies to leapfrog. They trade $250,000 a day. And what happens is, I could tell you for a fact that that stock would go up for the next 6 months for sure. Because three frontier Africa funds had just been raised, and there's no way they were not going to buy this Kenyan bank, because this Kenyan bank is one of the best stocks to own in Kenya. And since they were an Africa frontier fund, they were definitely going to buy things in Kenya. And so I knew that for the next 6 months, there's going to be a buyer of the stock every day, because they need to invest the money in this house. But I could also tell you that the day one of them has to sell, the stock will go down 80%. And that's just not what we like to do. Yeah. It's very tricky. So the answer is, I think frontiers are the right thing to do when you think the country's about to turn, and you invest it as a private equity, even though you're buying listed securities.
Treat it as a private equity.
And therefore, I think that there is interesting things in frontier, and I think in anybody's portfolio, I think it makes sense to have a little bit of, you know, the same way I think that it makes sense to have some VC, some angel stuff at any moment of time. Yeah. I think it makes sense to have some frontier, because countries do change.
Yeah.
And if you catch the initial move of the change, some of the returns can be amazing. And I know you like some of these, and I think that there's a lot of value to it. But you have to think about them a little bit differently from a portfolio point
of view. Yeah, exactly right. And my view on those is they're 5-year buy and hold.
Correct.
So like Morocco is something I'm interested in.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I'm never going to trade
Morocco. You put a certain percentage of your thing.
And you just leave
it. Because the problem for our industry is, for the mark-to-market industry, those things are tricky.
So to sum up, where you think the biggest opportunities are in the world, so it's Brazil.
Yeah, Brazil is obviously for me.
And Brazil, in what specific opportunities? I'm not asking for your portfolio.
I think that, you know, the economy in Brazil is going to stay depressed for a while. Although I agree with you, I think that we've probably seen the bottom. I don't see a situation of a big recovery really quickly.
Yeah.
So I think the big story in Brazil is going to be the collapse in rates. The inflation, effectively, which has already started to come down, really taking a leap lower, and these incredibly high real rates that exist in Brazil today effectively start really compressing. Because it's, you know, you're in this weird place in the world that look at the US, which has 2% growth plus, 1% inflation plus, and has negative, you know, real rates. And you have Brazil, which has negative 5% or 4% negative GDP growth and has 7% real rates. I mean, obviously, I understand there's all kinds of reasons, but I'm saying from a pure just rates economy growth dynamic, the world is kind of a little messed up right now. And I think that there's going to be compression. So I like things that are financial and things that have long-term cash flow asset characteristics to it.
Right, so because like did the Brazilian banks pick up finally? Because lending's collapsed.
And let me tell you, provisions are off the... We own banks, and I would tell you, people say to me like, oh, but how can you own the banks? The provision cycle is terrible. I said, the provision cycle is worse than terrible. It's actually the worst I've ever seen. I've looked at these banks for a long time. I don't remember them ever provisioning at the rate that they're provisioning. And they're provisioning at this incredible rate, and they're making 18% return on equity. Obviously, part of it is because rates are so high that they have a very good carry.
Mm-hmm.
And if rates are down, they will lose some of that carry, and that will hurt profitability. But of course, our assumption is if rates go down, et cetera, provisioning will collapse.
Yeah.
They provisioned in the last couple of quarters a third of their income. I mean, it's a crazy number how much these guys are provisioning these days. And therefore, they think, so we like the banks. We like assets that have long-term cash flow characteristics because if we're right on rates, effectively you're going to get the positive, you know, the PV effect of the rate compression. We think real estate is a place worth spending time now.
Interesting, at the round table again, we had a Brazilian family office talked about Eletrobras, which is a long-term cash flow business.
Yep.
And the other one was Brazilian REITs.
Yeah. Brazilian REITs are, look, you lived in Spain. Brazil real estate is, I wouldn't say it was Spain-like, but it was comparable.
Yeah.
The driver there was that the government was giving them a lot of funding for the average person to be able to buy homes, so there was a huge explosion of real estate. Some of them had better capital structures, some did not. And I think the asset price that you can buy now, the REITs that are focused on this, are much more interesting. So right now in Brazil, we like assets that are basically, as I said, cash flow characteristics. That's really what we're
interested in. They do well with falling rates.
Yeah, with falling rates. And you're not that worried about GDP's 2 or 3%. Like, you can make more aggressive bets and go into retail and things like this, but I think it's probably too early.
Yeah.
Probably too early. I don't think the economy is going to... I think right now what we need is stabilization. Then maybe we'll get a little bit... Because remember, we're still in a situation where we have a temporary government that we don't know... You know, there's this impeachment period until the impeachment gets confirmed by the Senate, which we think it will, but it's Brazil. You're never 100% sure. Then the president can stay until 2018, which means he has a little bit of a longer window to... do economic things. But the problem is Brazil right now, the confidence shock that Brazil needs is not a growth shock. They need a fiscal tightening shock.
Yeah.
The worry people have on Brazil is the fiscal numbers are out of control. And even though they're starting from a low debt to GDP number, that number can, you know, when you have 15% rates and a bad deficit, that can grow very quickly. So it's not a growth answer what the government can do. What the government can do is an investment and a fiscal tightening dynamic. And that's not ideal for growth related, but it's much more ideal for, I would say, financial related.
Yeah, so it doesn't sound like it's a overall necessary positive for the Brazilian equity market.
No.
As you say, it's a rate story and that flows through.
And that flows through. Okay. And exactly. And I think that's really, to me, the things you have a currency at the right level or closer to a right level, the rate story, that's what gets you. And obviously, I'm looking at this in the context of the world.
Yeah.
You know, if the environment and the investment world in the world was different, I may have changed my mind in it. I just think right now, when I look at, you know, I look at the situation, I think we're not particularly constructive on Europe because we think that there's some structural things that still take a long time. It's not that it's going to be the end of the world, but it's not very constructive and you're going to stay with low rates for a long period of time. The US is probably okay. I know you're more negative, but who knows? But it's not like you're buying things cheap.
No,
you know,
and the economy's not going to be strong.
Exactly,
so it's either muddled through.
Exactly,
or,
it's muddled through or recession. Recession, and you're paying reasonable multiples for companies. So it might be okay, but it's not exactly like, oh my god, I need to put all my money in the thing. And as I said, in Asia, you understand my concerns. X as a China thing. So I think on a relative basis, it's as I said, it's got a very good asymmetric dynamic.
And so, if you were to choose one short, where would it be? Asia, obviously, somewhere, would it be?
Not necessarily. You're saying an EM?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't have to be EM. I don't mind.
No. You mean one country short or one...
You tell me.
Well, this could get me more in trouble or not. But I'll say there's one trade that I think you would like.
Okay.
Although I think you generally like them, et cetera. But I think that the best tail risk insurance there is right now is puts on Deutsche Bank.
Oh, yeah. I think they're going bust, but anyway.
By the way, I think that they're going to get nationalized.
I don't think they're going to go bust. That's what I mean by going bust.
Exactly. The equity is going to...
It's going to
zero. I think
for
me, that's like the best hedge of any portfolio.
I agree.
By the way, and incredibly enough, you can still buy puts out of the money. Not that expensively, which I find crazy.
Yeah.
Because people are still my things. I in general, look, our biggest shorts, we do EM, but we do also a little bit of European things, etc.
European banks... are terrifying me again. The Spanish banks, I mean, Popular.
Yeah, Popular. But look, we are more worried about the Italian banks.
The Italian banks are a mess.
It's a total mess. And so the answer is, look, our shorts are a little bit more idiosyncratic. I wouldn't, you know, it's hard for me to tell you like this, you know, for example, in South Africa, people said like, oh, we don't like South Africa. The South Africa dynamic is poor because the politics are going the wrong way. And the problem in South Africa doesn't have an easy solution right away because of the ANC dominance. They don't have a real good system to revitalize themselves. It's not like what happened in Argentina, or let's go to the opposition. The opposition is still too small to, and it's going to take too long. The problem is in South Africa, a lot of the companies, you know, for example, people say, oh, you should be short South Africa. I say, well, look, when you look at the big companies in South Africa, are companies like Naspers that have nothing to do with South Africa. They own Tencent. They're literally, they have a cable business in South Africa, and then they own internet e-commerce business all over the place. And most of their value is from one asset in China. So that's not a good place to short. And so the answer is, look, I think that the places where we are not excited is Turkey.
Yeah.
Because you have...
I don't like
you. You have, first, if you're right on rates in terms of the US and et cetera, I think that that country is still more exposed. I think that they're unfortunately in the geopolitical middle of like six different bad trends. And they have a leader who is interventionist and erratic, which is always a bad combination. You know, the one thing with Putin is that he's fairly consistent in what he does. You know, I might not like it and people may not approve it, et cetera, which I'm not trying to make a political statement, but in generally, you kind of know what he's trying to do. Erdogan, you don't know, because you think he's going one way and then he does something and then he comes back. And for example, I would have never heard, like, and then on top of it, Putin would have never said, oh, you have to cut rates, or you, he would never, even him, he would do this, whereas Erdogan, so Turkey, we don't like as much, I think, on a credit, we're short on the credit space, places like Turkey, places like South Africa, because I think those, et cetera, more of our shorts are a little bit more idiosyncratic, so it's a little bit more complicated. But
I think the European banks overall are interesting on the short side.
Yeah, you should see some of the business plans that we see. I mean, they're like, if everything goes well in 2018, we'll make 6%.
Buy Brazilian bonds instead.
Like,
Edward, brilliant. This is what I think fashion. I think people's heads are going to spin off. We've talked so much around the world and talked about so many things. But
well, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much. I enjoyed reading all your material and I enjoyed seeing some interviews. And hopefully I haven't offended too many people.
No, and come down to Cayman next time.
I will.